Dean. Families are already left.
Good morning. The Senate Environment, Energy, and Natural Resources Budget Division will come to order. This is the first of several hearings that we're going to have, starting now, obviously, and leading up to the beginning of session, so we can try to give all senators who have proposals for the bonding bill in our division an opportunity to bring those forth and have a hearing and get members familiar with them, and then we can make some recommendations to the bonding committee before they finalize their bill. And members, I know we don't have all of our committee members here, but so I'll repeat this a few times, but we need to have a discussion at some point about what type of process we think would be most meaningful as we make our recommendations to the bonding committee. So we'll get to that as we go forward in the process. But as of now, we have bonding hearings scheduled for Monday and Friday next week, correct?
And then 9 a.m.
Next Monday and Friday at 9 a.m. And so I apologize for those who aren't here, who might not be able to be here. I know it's hard to fit these into schedules sometimes, but it's important to get this done as quickly as possible. And then we'll continue as the legislative session starts. We'll try to wrap up in the first week of session with our hearings. So with that, we'll start with Senator Chaudhry, who's here to present the Springbrook Nature Center bonding request. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for accelerating the hearing of this bill. The Springbrook Nature Center proposal has been funded by the Senate in the Senate's bonding bills on two separate occasions in two different cycles. The most recent last year, it was funded by the legislature and was vetoed by the governor. So this is the third bonding cycle with which we are bringing this forward. We have high hopes that it can pass this year. The only update that we have is that because it's the time has passed since the original proposal, the amount that we're requesting has increased from $2.5 million to $3.1 million. If staff could make a note of that, we came to this calculation from the Department of Finance and according to inflationary costs. So we're at $3.1 million for this proposal. The Senate has funded this bill. The legislature has funded this bill because of the importance of that Springbrook Nature Center places on the environment and environmental education on a statewide and national basis. This is not a local project, nor is this really a regional project. This is a statewide educational center for the environment. It serves 150,000 visits each year from 300 different Minnesota communities, all 50 states, and 60 foreign countries. Several years ago, Springbrook Nature Center was named amongst the first seven important birding areas by the National Audubon Society. It's received a Champion of Open Spaces Award, noted by the Star Tribune as must-see destinations, number one park nature center for families in the Minnesota Parent magazine, one of 13 hotspots in Twin Cities to view wildlife, according to the Minnesota DNR. The bonding committee has visited Springbrook Nature Center on two different occasions, and I hope we're impressed enough by it, given the fact that the Senate has funded it on two different occasions. So to talk to you a little bit more about Springbrook Nature Center is members of the Springbrook Nature Center board and staff. I just want to note that inside is some of the concept design for the expansion of Springbrook Nature Center. But most importantly, note that Springbrook Nature Center actually began in its inception a half a block from the home where I grew up. Every Wednesday afternoon after school, my brother would go to Springbrook Nature Center, which at that time was just an A-frame in front of, at the beginning of a path going into some woods. And he would be the intern there working under Cy Sinclair when he was just in elementary school, helping feed the snakes and giving water to the turtles and all of that. And so this is a very special place for me and our family personally. And my my brother, who is as we speak interviewing with for a right hand man job with the U.S. Air Force Chief of Staff, has stated that his experience in leading him to the U.S. Air Force Academy and being a pilot with 700 combat hours, with everything that he has experienced in the Air Force, was greatly impacted by the experience that he learned about at Springbrook Nature Center. So with that, I want to introduce Malcolm Mitchell, who is chairman of the board.
Great. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Again, my name is Malcolm Mitchell. I'm the volunteer chair of the board at Springbrook Nature Center Foundation. Just to give you a little background, first of all, I want to say thank you to all of you who supported in the past the bonding as part of the bonding bill and the entire Senate. So thank you for that, for past support. The Springbrook Nature Center is owned by the City of Fridley, and the staff, Sia St. Clair is the director, is an employee of the City of Fridley, and therefore, and the land is located in the surroundings of the City of Fridley, on the northern side of that. At the same time, a separate nonprofit organization called Springbrook Nature Center Foundation was created in the mid-70s, and I am chair of that foundation board. We're a local board. In many cases, you might say we're a Friends of Springbrook voluntary board. Our mission is to enhance and at times protect Springbrook. In fact, we went to bat very strongly a few years ago when the City of Fridley had said this is something that with the cuts in funding that we're receiving, Springbrook needs to have a tremendous reduction in its staff, etc. And we said no, this is something important. The result of that was in 2004, the citizens of Fridley passed a referendum that gave tax support on an ongoing basis to support Springbrook Nature Center and the basic programs there. So the City of Fridley and the surrounding communities have stepped up to the plate, and we're now looking to say, let us help us to enhance and further enhance Springbrook Nature Center. Our role in this particular effort is that we're looking for the state legislature through the bonding bill to support $3.1 million. We, as the foundation board, have indicated we'll do the heavy lifting, and we've committed to raise the local match. So our process is to move forward and raise the $2.5 million from local sources that would be needed to complete the entire project. And with that, I think I'm just going to end there and turn it to Sia St. Clair, who's the director, to talk a little bit more about the specifics of Springbrook and the project we're talking about.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity. I am Sia St. Clair. I'm the director of Springbrook Nature Center. I've been there now for 30 years. So that was a few years ago when we were working with Senator Chaudhary's brother and had him working with us at the center, at the Nature Center. And I just wanted to say that I left about an hour, 15 minutes ago, I left 120 seventh graders and to teach wilderness survival. We're going to be outside teaching them how to build fires and shelters this morning, to come down here and face a different kind of challenge for that. Yes.
Wilderness survival.
Different kind of survival, yes. situation. Pardon me? Those are Fridley, yes, 120 Fridley 7th graders. We had the other 120 of them yesterday. Springbrook Nature Center is the largest natural area park as you come north out of Minneapolis. It's 127 acres of native habitat that's never been disturbed. So it's very unusual in that capacity, and because it's never been disturbed in any way, it has a lot of wildlife, a lot of diversity of wildlife and plant life, native habitats, native prairie, native forests, native wetlands that are there. And because of all of that, we have a tremendous amount of diversity of wildlife and plant life at the park. And with that diversity ends up Because we have that, we end up being a great attraction for people. And that's one of the reasons we have so many people coming out to the Nature Center on a regular basis. Springbrook is a destination for people that come to the park. As you saw a few minutes ago, they're coming from many different areas. I have a slide dealing with that, and I'll go over that really quickly. But it's a popular destination for families, individuals, and couples that come out to the center. We educate thousands every year. We see every Fridley student 4 times a year, K through 8, plus many, many other schools. We motivate teens to positive life values. In the lower left on this picture, you can see here some of the teens that we work with in our summer day camp programs with their junior leaders that we have there. We have a huge volunteer program there. We couldn't function without our volunteers. Last year, we had about 500 volunteers, putting in over 16,000 hours of volunteer work at the center. We host a number of community events over the course of the year, even for a very small facility that we have there. On our Halloween program this past fall, we had 3,300 people. We're still trying to figure out where they all parked when they came out, but they really enjoy the ambiance that Springbrook brings and as a place for families with young children to be able to come out and enjoy the facility that we have. Springbrook is one of the reasons that it's very popular amongst the people who come out there. We have huge numbers of people is because of the fact that it's so accessible. We're just a couple of miles north of 694. We're less than a mile away from Highway 610 and 10, just a little bit to the north of us. So for cars, we're very easily accessible. We have a bike trail that's going to be going in across our northern boundary that's going to connect up two other trails, so we'll be connected into the regional trail system. Hopefully by the end of this year, there's a Metro bus hub half a mile away from the Nature Center, and the bus route runs right across the front of our entrance. And so there's a bus stop at the entrance to the Nature Center. North Star Commuter Rail is our western boundary. So when that gets put in, there's going to be a stop just a short ways away from the Nature Center, and we have over 8 entrances to the park. So one of the reasons Springbrook Nature Center is extremely popular and has worked so well as it has as for all the programs that we give is because of the fact that it is so accessible. We do reach way beyond our local area. As Senator Chaudhry said a moment ago, over 350 cities in the last year or so have signed into our logbook and our entrance. All people from all 50 states and people from well over 60 foreign countries just in the last year or so are coming out. We're a place where people who have visitors come to them bring their visitors and family and friends when they come into the metro area as a place to show off the kind of place that they live. Just an example then, not just people who walk in to walk our trails and do those kinds of activities and to see our small exhibit area. The programming activities that we do just in this past year, we've had students come to the Nature Center or we go out to them from over 38 different communities. So while we're a function of the city, we're much more regional aspect in what we do when we go out long distances for the programming and activities that we did, that we are doing on a daily basis. As Senator Chaudhry mentioned, the National Audubon Society right now and the Audubon Societies around the world are designated what they call important bird areas to try to preserve those areas all over the world. And when they came to Minnesota and were selecting the first ones that they thought were the most important birding areas and areas for birds in Minnesota, Springbrook Nature Center was one of the first 8 that they selected, and it was the only one within the metro area that they selected. So it was it is really recognized not just as a place where we're doing a lot of education, but also as an important area for wildlife itself. And all of this popularity is kind of why we're before you today, because the use of Springbrook is just increasing at an alarming rate to those of us who are managing it. And we're really concerned, along with this bike trail project, we know that's going to bring more people in. We've just done a number of wetland improvements to the park. We know that brings a lot more people in. Met Council has projected increases in households up to 25% over the next 20 years. So we know that our use is going to continue to increase. And our concern then is to make sure that the fragile ecosystems that we're dealing with here aren't going to be loved to death by the great numbers of people who are coming out there. So we've been meeting and working on how we're going to solve that problem. And what we've come up with is a plan to enhance the 5% of the park, the first 7-acre areas right in the entrance, to try to have a lot of the use that comes out to the park be focused in this area. A lot of people, for instance, we're partnering with the hospitals. They bring people who have had heart bypass operations or heart attacks, and they need to come out and they need to walk 100 yards, and then tomorrow 125 yards, and the next day 150 yards. They don't need to go back and impact the entire park. But right now we don't really have facilities for that to be able to accomplish that. We have groups that call us that want to bring schools, for instance. Like I said, I just left 120 seventh graders. A lot of schools today can only bring kids out if they can bring them a whole grade at a time, which is like 300 or 400 kids. And we can't accommodate that many with the facilities that we have right now. So we're looking at utilizing the 7 acres and really having that fixed up so that we can handle a lot of use in that area so that the rest of the park is going to be able to be preserved and saved from not having overuse in the area. And you have this drawing in front of you in the little pamphlet that we sent out. This is the overall site drawing, conceptual drawing that we have. One of the things that we want to do is to make this a very green experience, not just for us, but for contractors and other people that can come out and use it as a place to see how this works. If we can make a parking lot that uses a permeable surface, and so that you don't have to have places where the water's going to run off to go into, because the water goes right down into the groundwater system underneath the parking lot. Contractors can come out and use it as a place to find out whether or not that works and how it works and what we have to do to keep it, maintain it. So as they're building, they can do the same thing at their areas. We're going to be putting heat pumps underneath the parking lot and using that as a way to heat and cool the building. And then we'll have an exhibit on the inside about how that works. So because we're a public facility, we can be accessible for contractors and for homeowners and other people to be able to turn their places in to green design and use it. Our building is already built on green design. When we built it 1980-81, it's an underground building. So it was already set up with green design, and we're going to continue that with the design that we're adding on to right now with a building that has solar panels on it, and using those, having exhibits inside that explain all those costs and how much we're saving in costs and things like that that go with that. Outdoor classrooms are an important part of what we're doing as well, to work with these kids that we just left this morning and not impact the back part of the park. Also a larger exhibit area to be able to deal with the increased use that we're having out there. And we have a lot of businesses that call us that want to have a place to come for day retreats, but our facility really can't accommodate that right now. So we would have structures that we could do that with within this building itself and accommodate a lot of those uses within the needs and requests that we get. Along with these improvements to the site to be able to try to save this park from being used love to death, we do have a business plan that goes out a number of years that demonstrates that we're going to be able to have the revenue and have the income coming in to be able to accommodate the increased costs that we're going to have because of the increased spaces and things that we'll have on the site. So that's what the program is, and that's why we're doing it, is to accommodate this constantly increasing use of this park, to try to make sure that we maintain this jewel that we have within what is now an urban setting. When I first started working there, we were really in the rural area, but the urban setting has really moved out beyond us now, and we have intensive use at the Nature Center. So thank you very much for your time and consideration for this proposal.
Thank you very much, Mr. St. Clair. Are you going to speak as well?
No, I am not.
Okay. Well, I really appreciate what you're doing with your building and incorporating all these renewable energy solutions for trying to keep your costs down and also to demonstrate to people the connection between preserving nature and preserving our environment. That's really what everyone should be doing with our, you know, with our bonding dollars. So that's great. And I'm getting spring fever just looking at those photos. I want to go right now and be outside there. It looks beautiful.
Thank you.
Senator Dill.
Yeah, Madam Chair, perhaps Senator Chaudhary knows the answer to this. I think it's impressive that this 127 acres has never been disturbed. I can understand how that happened after the city of Fridley owned it, but what was the history prior to that it was an ownership that didn't allow it to be disturbed?
Madam Chair, Senator, the history of Springbrook was that in the 30s, it was a part of it was a dairy farm. And so the only thing that they ever did with it was they actually grazed cattle on it. But they've never gone in and plowed any of it. It's never been timbered. It may have been timbered in the 1800s sometime, but there are 200-year-old trees on this within the park. And I think it was because there's so many wetlands. Over 46% of the property is wetlands. So it's very difficult to get into. There was a period of time in the 50s and 60s when a roofing contractor was using it as a place to dump shingles when he was doing that. And so when the city purchased the properties in the early 70s, they went in and they cleaned it all out, all the debris from that. But other than that, it had by not being disturbed, we're looking at it from an environmental standpoint that the ground has never been tilled, it's never been plowed up in any way. And so we have original native vegetation, which is really what's unusual. We have native prairies that are there that have never been disturbed. I have seen a picture from the 30s of a farmer who had a wagon with horses pulling it down in some of the wetland areas, actually haying. So he was harvesting the prairie grasses to use as feed for livestock. But in the sense of not being disturbed, it hasn't been dug up or had buildings put on it that you had to remove or anything like that.
That's amazing. And is there any land around it that is, open space that could be acquired to build onto it, or is it all fully developed around this?
Unfortunately, when I first started working there, there was lots of land around it. Now we have a Walmart is our eastern boundary neighbor. A large apartment complex is also on our eastern boundary. Our southern boundary is industrial. Our northern boundary is also industrial and commercial. And our western boundary is the railroad tracks, and on the other side of that is houses, so single-family houses and townhomes. So we're completely surrounded now by developed land.
Madam Chair, you're going to talk a little later about wastewater. And maybe Saya can talk about the effects that
the filtering
that we provide for free to our community.
Right. we've just completed a year and a half ago a Clean Water Partnership grant that we worked with the Pollution Control Agency and many other agencies that we worked with on that. It was about an $800,000 project because our wetlands within the park, we have extensive wetlands in the Nature Center that were being seriously impacted because all of the development with these large, especially commercial areas and industrial areas to the north and east of us, when it would rain, the water in the creek that comes through the Nature Center would jump in within 20 minutes, would come up 4 feet. And so it was like a freight train coming through the park, and it was eroding that. And then as the water hit our larger wetland areas and ponded areas, all of the silt that had been picked up from the erosion in those creeks would drop out, and our 4 foot deep wetland areas, beautiful wetland areas, had filled in very rapidly because of that. So with this partnership grant, we were able to restore the wetlands and change the creek and do some work upstream to slow the water down so that now we have our wetlands back. In fact, the species that we were documenting as the ones that had disappeared because the wetlands had degraded have all reached, every single one of them that we had identified have returned. That was black terns we've seen back in the park now nesting. Least bitterns are nesting in the park again. Yellow-headed blackbirds are nesting in the park again. We had a great seed bank left in some of the wetlands so that when we drew the wetlands down, we had over 100 species, native species that came back out of just from the seed bank that was left in the ground from previous years. So we have incredible wetlands now. We did a study just last year of coliform bacteria, and there's a lot of coliform coming in to the Nature Center because of the ponded areas with all the geese and ducks ahead of us. But because the wetlands are so improved now, the coliform was practically down to zero as it left the park, which is exactly what the wetlands are supposed to do. Because immediately downstream from the Nature Center are the water intakes in the Mississippi River for the cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul. So we want clean water coming out of this park before it goes into those water intakes for Minneapolis and St. Paul.
Well, thank you. I live in St. Paul. I appreciate that because I drink that water. But I think, you know, that's real progress that you're making. It would be great if your community can work with some of those, you know, the Walmarts and the other developments to try to get them to do permeable surfaces to try to help that problem because, you know, it takes everybody. It takes the whole surrounding watershed to really change that.
And so we're hoping to be an example of that.
Great. Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I apologize for being late, so I hope I'm not asking something you already presented. What is the size of the park? And it seems to me, maybe I misheard you, but you said that you're trying to reduce the impact on the preserve and so focus people into a certain area. So when 150,000 people come, what are they doing when they come out there if they're not going into the rest of the preserve?
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Rummel, when we have that many people coming out, as we've watched and we've studied this over the years to try to figure out how we can try to keep the park from being loved to death, we do have an enormous number of uses of the Nature Center. Like a group of moms will come out with a whole bunch of little kids, and they really don't want to walk a mile and a half on the trails back into the park. If we can have a short trail like this design shows, that's just less than a third of a mile, a couple of hundred yards, with some sculpture things that kids can play on and climb on and things like that, and places where they can sit down and relax, we find that that's what they would prefer to do that rather than taking the kids on a mile and a half jaunt back through the park. And as I said, with the health and wellness activities that we do in these partnerships with the hospitals, they have a lot of people who want to come out. They need to come out and just walk 50 yards or 75 yards or 100 yards and then try to keep increasing that every day from a wellness standpoint and then increase people who have heart conditions and things. And if we have spaces like we're presenting here for those people, a lot of those uses don't end up going back into the park. They can be focused just in the entrance area. A lot of our events, the one where we had 3,300 people, if we've set this area up like we've presented here, we can focus that use just within that 7 acres, and we don't have to have those people going back into the park itself. So that way we're able to relieve a lot of the pressure on the rest of the park and are able to maintain the fragile ecosystems with less intensive use.
But primarily, Senator Rummel, is the educational activities there. It's an environmental learning center for tens of thousands of students every year, not only from our area, but from across the state.
Thousands? Senator Rummel.
Just follow up. I appreciate that, and I understood that. But do people actually go into the other part for other activities?
Yes. Just to
Mitchell.
Senator Rummel, just to respond to that question, anyone can go into the broader park at any time. There are no gateways or something that prevents that. What we're saying is that if you're there to enjoy the outdoors and to walk the trails, you have that opportunity every time.
Okay.
We're not trying to prohibit anybody from doing that. At the same time, if you don't need to do that, we can protect that a little bit and enhance it by not having it overused, where we can concentrate the effort in 7 acres where it makes sense to do so. So it's not like it's a separate. We don't have, as I say, we won't have gateways that prevent. Everybody can walk and enjoy what they need at the time.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much. And I know we've supported this in the past in the Bonney Bill, and it's a little frustrating. You have to do it again, but we're going to do our best to help you. Thank you so much for your presentation.
Thank you very much.
Oh, and I need each of the testifiers to please sign in. There's a sign-in sheet on the table. Thank you.
It's been in there.
All right. Next, we'll have the Pollution Control Agency come up. Here, I'm going to ask.
I saw one very similar to this, if I didn't see this one.
Welcome to the committee.
Pollution Control. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Christine Johnson. I'm the Legislative Director for the Pollution Control Agency. And thank you so much for asking us to present today. We're happy to be here. We have two projects today to present on our list that are of high priority for the PCA and very important to the well-being of Minnesotans and their environment. And since we do have two projects, Madam Chair, I didn't know if it would be preferable to answer questions after the first or after we present our entire presentation.
Oh, I don't know. We can just sort of see. Go with the flow.
Okay.
I'll just let the members, if they have burning questions, we'll let them jump in after your initial testimony.
First on the list is the Pope Douglas Resource Recovery Expansion Project. And when you're looking at this project, it's important to keep in mind the waste hierarchy that was enacted by the legislature. And the MPCA strongly supports reducing waste up front, and part of that includes recycling and waste energy. They are an important part of meeting this objective. And with that, I will introduce Rick Patra. He is our Manager of Community Development within the Prevention and Assistance Division at the agency.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, in addition to the PowerPoint presentation that you have, there's also, I had handed out some supplemental information that I think you might find helpful to be able to look at later on. There's fact sheets and various things like that that, like I said, could be helpful. So the MPC.
You need to start by identifying yourself, please.
I'm sorry. Rick Patra with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency.
Thank you.
Madam Chairs and members of the committee, the MPCA administers the Solid Waste Processing Facilities Capital Assistance Program. I'm going to refer to it as CAP since it's so long, so Capital Assistance Program. The CAP program began in 1980, I'm on the first slide, as part of the Waste Management Act. The program was designed to encourage and assist cities and counties and solid waste management districts and sanitary districts develop and implement sound integrated solid waste management systems. The goal of the Waste Management Act is to foster integrated solid waste management, to manage waste for its highest and best use based on the characteristics of the waste stream. And what we mean by that is reuse and waste reduction programs would be in place. Recyclable materials would be recycled. Household hazardous waste and things like that would be removed and managed properly. Yard waste would be recovered. Energy could be derived from waste suitable for waste to energy. And lastly, materials that would not be suitable for resource recovery would be landfilled. Thus, it would reduce or minimize our long-term risks, liabilities, costs, and care associated with those. CAP is a statewide program, and as you can see from the map that's to the right there, the state and county investments in meeting the policies set forth in the Act have positioned Minnesota as a national leader in waste management. We've got projects all across the state. The CAP program, this is an important thing too, is meant to be a catalyst for regional cooperation with special consideration given to those projects that serve more than one county. So the greater number of the counties participating, the greater the funding that is available for the project, which helps tremendously in rural Minnesota with the economies of scale needed. CAP incorporates a number of criteria. I just want to briefly go through. It needs to ensure that the Waste Management Act's preferred waste management practices are being followed. It needs to look at regional cooperation and determine if regional opportunities do exist and whether or not they've been pursued. The counties have to have an approved comprehensive solid waste management plan. The project needs to be technical and financially feasible, and the project has to have a realistic timetable for permits and development. I'm on the next slide. Developing strong partnerships between the state and local units of government are critical when addressing waste management issues. The PCA works to support local governments evolve integrated solid waste management through a variety of tools, and CAP is one of those tools. CAP supports both the front-end technologies and the preferred technologies that are needed to deal with the reality that we still have waste that need to be handled. CAP doesn't just support waste energy project, but it's been instrumental in providing financial assistance across the state, for recycling facilities, household hazardous waste facilities, composting, and materials recovery facilities. In short, or basically, the facilities CAP helps them recover resources and convert to better technologies faster. Since 1980, we've issued over 92 grants to varying projects across the state. If you could refer to the map on that slide to the right for just a moment, the state has expended nearly $53 million since the program, with a 3-to-1 return in investment by the counties, who've made approximately $188 million investment, for a total of $241 million since 1980, which has supported, and I believe positioned, again, Minnesota very well as one of the national leaders for integrated solid waste management. Another benefit of CAP is that it reduces environmental risks and the potential liabilities associated with landfilling, and it does create jobs. Next slide. The governor's 2008 budget recommendation for the CAP program is $9,605,000 for the counties of Pope Douglas for expanding their resource recovery facility. The map shows the regional cooperation potential for the project. I've got a colored copy, so I was going to have you refer to the two green boxes, but I think yours is going to show that they're just the darker ones. That's the Pope Douglas facility. The project would include up to 7 counties in Minnesota. So in addition to the Pope Douglas, those others in the gray there would include the counties of Benton, Grant, Sherburne, Stearns, and Stephen. And the Pope Douglas facility, for reference, is located in the city of Alexandria. Next slide. The Pope Douglas Solid Waste Sharing Powers Board, it was formed in 1983 for the purpose of exploring options to own and operate a solid waste management system that met the long-term needs of the residents in their counties. It was voted on by the residents of both counties to build the waste-to-energy plant versus a new landfill, thereby committing to the goals of the Waste Management Act. The facility was built, they built the waste energy facility in 1986 and they began the operations in 1987. They made additional improvements by putting in countywide recycling in 1988. They began a household hazardous waste program in 1992. And they built a waste energy upfront materials recovery and recycling facility in 2003. And I want to talk about that just a little bit because it's very important in terms of the enhancement that the facility has made because of putting in that equipment. We call it a MRF. Some people call it pre-sort, but it's another sorting system up front that enhances recycling and taking out materials. That facility, the materials recovery facility, has a number of benefits, like I was saying. It removes harmful items from the waste to help clean up emissions. And so it's very important for a waste energy facility to have this type of thing up front so that they can deal with materials that come in unexpectedly that they have to deal with day to day. And the things that you would think that are out of the waste stream oftentimes are not. They're still being put in the containers. So lead acid batteries, mercury thermostats, oil filters, gypsum, tubes, electronics, CRTs, all these types of things still come in, and that MRF deals with those things. It also reduces items that cause slag, which can bring downtime to the facility. So by removing the glass and aluminum, that creates a more efficient operation. participating counties will also see an increase in their recycling rates. This doesn't eliminate or forego the other counties having to have curbside source-separated recycling. But what it does is it means that the other materials that are coming in, it's another chance for more materials to be taken out. And so their recycling rates would probably expect to be go up probably somewhere between 7 and 10%. Next slide. Expansion plans. Projections show that Pope Douglas demand will reach 120 tons per day by the year 2015. The reason for that is the area is experiencing growth in population and per capita waste generation. It's a destination spot. People have found that it's a good place to retire. There's lakes there. There's tourism. The city itself is growing and expanding, and more businesses are coming in. They plan to expand the permitted capacity from 80 tons per day to 120 tons per day by using their existing equipment to the fullest. They add a third incinerator with 120 ton per day capacity to reach a total capacity of 240 tons per day. And then the third combustor that they would be adding on would add 40,000 pounds of additional steam for industrial or other users of users or generating electricity for sale back to the grid. And then the 240 ton per day capacity would meet Pope Douglas's demand through the year 2030. Next slide. Regarding the expansion benefits, presently the board employs 31 full-time and 4 part-time employees. Between the waste energy facility, the MRF, and the household hazardous waste and the recycling center, the expansion would add approximately 8 employees for the waste energy or the MRF. The MRF is not going to be expanding. The facility is. The MRF would be adding another line and just operating more to handle all the additional increase of waste that would be coming in. Thus, more employees would be put online. Regarding the environment and energy, the expansion would continue to support the goals of the Waste Management Act and integrated solid waste management systems and provide more opportunities than for its industrial location to maximize the use of their steam. The map that you see on the right. Again, I apologize, but you can see it. You should be able to. The Pope Douglas Waste Energy Facility, you'll see in the middle in the far right. Their main two customers right now for their steam are 3M in Alexandria, located close, and then the Pope Douglas County Hospital. And the Alexandria Technical College, which you see there as well, is also interested in receiving their steam in the future, possibly for the entire campus. And the timing when they may do that expansion would be around 2010. The 3M expansion, 3M is also interested in expanding their facility and potentially could increase their steam use by 8-fold. And the Douglas County Hospital is also interested in expanding and would be interested in acquiring more steam from what they're referring to as green sources or renewable sources of energy. Next slide. So in summary, Pope Douglas is a joint powers board that works together very effectively. The facility has been operating effectively since the late 1980s, and it's operating presently at full capacity. The industrial location of the facility allows a great opportunity to maximize their use of steam. With the use of CAP funds, Pope Douglas retrofitted their air pollution control equipment in 1997, and our emissions are well controlled. They added a pre-sort system, or the MRF I had spoken about, to recover recyclables and reject non-combustible items using their own funds. This increased their recycling, it reduced air emissions, and it reduced their downtime. In 2006, the PCA received their preliminary application in response to our CAP funding round. Pope Douglas proposed an expansion of the waste-to-energy project's capacity to accommodate growth in the waste stream and to accommodate waste from potentially five neighboring counties. Again, those counties are Benton, Grant, Sherburne, Stearns, and Stevens. And MPCA rated the project very high. Again, the project serves a multi-county region that is experiencing growth in their population and the per capita generation. This isn't unique, incidentally, to the Alexandria area in terms of per capita generation. That's a trend that's statewide. The region proposed to be served by the expansion uses an integrated solid waste management system for waste management that incorporates a number of very important components. Household hazardous waste management. They have waste education programs. They have recycling, both curbside recycling, source separated, and additional waste and pre-sorting at the facility once the waste arrives. They have yard waste programs. They have waste energy and land disposal of the residuals and ash. Presently, Pope Douglas is at about a 90% to 95% landfill abatement of waste, which I think is incredible, and that's why we're very supportive and of this project, and it meets the spirit of the Waste Management Act and intent of it. So with that, Madam Chair and members of the committee, I have some contact information, and I thank you for the opportunity to present this.
All right. Thank you very much. We didn't really – so we're going to do the other project second.
Washington County will be next. I just didn't know if you had any questions.
Yeah, I do have some questions. Okay. So you said – I think what you said Mr. Petra, is per capita generation of waste, of solid waste, is going up around the state as well as in these counties. Can you tell me, I just would like some numbers, how much more garbage is everyone producing, and how's the recycling rate in those counties? Is it going up? Is it going down? Is it static? Mm-hmm. And what are the goals?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, yes, Minnesota and nationally, waste generation per capita has been increasing. It just so happens that I have a chart, and I'm sorry that I don't have more of these, but I can certainly supply them. This chart represents just a kind of a basic representation of the trends in Minnesota waste management. And what it shows is that despite all of our investment that we've put in and all the recycling and the abatement that is going on statewide, that nonetheless waste generation is continuing to increase. Right now we're running at about a little over 6 million tons per year in Minnesota. And recycling has flattened out. Our solid waste policy report that is due to the legislature this year does have, I believe, is going to have some ambitious and some interesting policy things to try to get at more recycling. But waste to energy and other resource recovery has flattened out. And landfilling is actually on the rise. And so in the PCA strategic plan, our proposal is to switch those numbers around where we have more resource recovery opportunities statewide, that we continue to push and have different strategies in place to try to get at more recyclables in the waste stream.
Can I just ask a question?
And to reduce landfilling.
I think you said at some point that when you go through your criteria for funding these waste-to-energy facilities, you look at what those communities are doing in terms of trying to meet the requirements of reduce, reuse, recycle, you know. So what are they doing in these counties? Are they doing anything better? Or are we just saying we're going to burn more garbage because you're producing more garbage? Are we requiring them to do more in recycling as in partnership with building this waste-to-energy facility? are we just sort of creating an incentive for more garbage by building this?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I don't believe so. I think that the fact that Pope Douglas proactively put in that materials recovery facility, you know, it indeed did help clean up the operation and improve air emissions, but the counties are very committed to meeting the intent of the Waste Management Act and are very serious about recovery and upfront recycling and those types of things.
Do you have any numbers for me?
Yeah,
I mean,
presently,
I'm just asking for specifics.
Sure.
Presently,
the Pope Douglas combined are recycling almost 50% of their waste.
Okay, that's above the state average. That's good.
Yeah, and for rural counties, actually, that's well above. The goal is 35% in rural Minnesota, so they're well beyond that. It's 50% in the metropolitan area.
So why is the goal only 35%?
Madam Chair.
I don't think it's high enough. If people are exceeding it already, I think we need a higher goal.
I think that is, Madam Chair, members, I think that that is an excellent point, and we've had policy discussions in our for our policy report internally about how to get more ambitious goals out in the rural areas and strategies, how we can get more of that. That was put into 1996 and probably could be revisited.
So so I guess what I have to say I don't know much about solid waste policy. But in St. Paul, where we've had an incredibly vigorous discussion about whether to start burning garbage, and there's a great deal of community opposition to that idea, we've had a lot of discussion about our solid waste policy as a consequence. And I've learned a lot from this and really learned that we can save money and reduce carbon emissions if we have a more aggressive policy of reducing and recycling. So, and that really, I think a lot of our incentives and a lot of our state dollars are aimed at the opposite direction, which is to encourage more waste to feed these garbage burners. So it really concerns me a lot. And so I want to know, you said that you look at that in your criteria, but are you really requiring, before we come up with all these taxpayer dollars to build to expand garbage burning or waste to energy burning, are we requiring counties to do more in reducing waste at the same time? I mean, they already are doing quite well, and I applaud them for that they're above average. But what are you requiring them to do as part of this analysis? You said that's part of your criteria, but I still haven't heard what you're asking for from these counties.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, the requirements are that the counties reach a 35% recycling goal. And so, but most of the counties have invested well beyond any contributions that SCORE and other dollars have put forth on these types of things. And so from our end, they have to complete comprehensive solid waste management plans. And in those plans, they have to keep looking for solutions and program development to try to get more and more at the upper end of the hierarchy with the reduce and reuse and so forth and recycling. So in their county solid waste management plans, they do have a requirement to ensure that those programs are in place and are being done as well as possible. It's a requirement of planning.
I think you've convinced me our goals are way too low. If we're not even, we can do much better, and we're not asking them to do anything beyond what they're already doing in order to justify this large expenditure. So I think that shame on us for not doing that. So can I ask also, in terms of the building itself, the expansion of the building, are they planning to incorporate any energy savings plans into that construction process?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I don't have that information. Pete Olmscheid, the executive director of the facility, is here. If you'd like, maybe he could answer that question.
Yeah, we don't have a lot of time, but I'd love to get a brief answer to that question. That'd be great. Thank you. You know, members, I just want to point out while he's coming up, if he could come up, that'd be great. You know, I've been looking at the statutes. I met with the Department of Administration yesterday. We have a law that's been on the books since at least the 1980s, 16B.32, that requires when we're building buildings with state dollars that those plans look at incorporating solar or geothermal or other energy savings or renewable energy capacity in them. And basically what I heard from the Department of Administration is that it's just not happening. They're not doing it, and they couldn't come up with one example where that had been done in a state building in over 20 years. I mean, it's really, in today's world, that's not acceptable. I mean, with the goals that we have for reducing greenhouse gas emissions. Now, we also have really strong laws in terms of energy efficiency requirements for proposed state buildings. And I think I was glad to hear it sounds like those are being followed more rigorously, but I want to make sure I ask that question in every Bonnie proposal. How is that? Are we really going to meet those requirements, too, and are our state agencies applying those laws? Because we're required to have new buildings be 30% more efficient than state building codes. Under law, that's the requirement now, and we need to make sure that our public dollars are being put to good use and the state is leading. So, with that, I just want to ask you, sorry, I don't mean to put you on the spot as my first target to ask that question, but welcome to the committee.
Thank you for having me, Madam Chair. I'm Pete Ohmscheid, the Director of Pope Douglas Solid Waste Management. One thing I can say about energy efficiencies is that we strive at all times to try to make everything as efficient as far as operations, high-efficiency motors, air conditioning units, and so forth. But to do with cap bonding and cap funds, part of our proposal is for the cap funding is for final engineering and getting the energy efficient standards and so forth incorporated with our design. So at this time right now, we don't have all of the final engineering completed, so I cannot tell you exactly where all the energy efficient items would be incorporated into the facility. I can tell you that in a waste-to-energy facility, the most important thing for energy conservation, of course, is electricity, the amount of motors and so forth that are involved with it. As far as heating and air conditioning, there is very little heating that needs to be done in the facility because of the radiant heat coming off of the combustors and so forth. So for the most part, most of our energy conservation will be centered on electric motors and air conditioning units and so forth. We talk about impermeable surfaces and so forth. We have a stormwater plan in place for our facility already. We are going to be taking up this, our building addition will be on an impermeable surface already, so we will not be changing the dynamics of our footprint area as we speak right now.
You're producing steam. Is there some way you could co-generate electricity out of your facility to create your own electricity supply?
Madam Chair, currently we produce steam. Steam is our number one steam sales, or selling steam mm-hmm. to the 3M company and the Douglas County Hospital is our priority right now. But we do have in-house currently a generator that we do run when there is excess steam available. We do co-generate at this time. Our generator is capable of producing 500 kilowatt hours of electricity. It offsets our electrical cost by about three-quarters, or in other words, it'll provide three-quarters of the electricity we need. So that is how we are balancing our electrical load at the moment. The summer months when our steam customers do not need all of the steam that we can produce because of the atmosphere and so forth, we run our generator and produce a lot of electricity. With our expansion, we are proposing to put in a second turbine generator, and at that time we will be producing more electricity than what the facility needs, so we will be pushing electricity to the grid at that time.
That's great. Thank you. Would you say there's broad community support for what you're doing at your plant and for the expansion?
Yes, there is, Madam Chair. The communities the surrounding our two counties, Pope and Douglas counties, the city of Alexandria, the city of Glenwood. It's a very popular thing for us. To us, it's a big comment when or compliment when people call us and have to ask where we're located at in the city because they don't even know we're there at all. You know, it's to us, that's a heck of a compliment. And we feel and we know that because of all the... When Pope Douglas was built in 1987, we were on the very edge of the city with a lot of lowlands around us. Right now, there's industry building up all right around us. None of them are afraid of us at all, so we feel we're a good neighbor. The communities support us greatly.
Can you please just state your name for our records, please?
My name is Pete Ohmscheid.
Okay, and if you could sign in the witness list, I'd appreciate
that. Okay.
Thank you so much. Go ahead, please, Ms. Johnson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, just to touch on Rick's answer to your question about what incentives are out there, just to clarify that this facility will be dealing with waste that could have otherwise gone to a landfill. I don't know if that...
Well, it could have been recycled. That's my point. It may be we could...
Understanding that as well. And just to clarify.
I understand. You know, I understand that. And I understand, you know, that landfill versus waste to energy, that's one calculation. That's an important one to make. But I think, you know, as our hierarchy requires in state law for really good reasons, it's better to reduce the waste. It's a lot cheaper, and it's a lot lower carbon emissions if we do that instead of landfilling or burning. And so that's really, I just think our state needs to go in that direction, and that's what our laws require us to do. So I just want to be really aggressive to make sure we're following that law and that policy.
If I may add one more thing, Madam Chair, they were talking a little bit about the upfront recycling center. Mm-hmm. That upfront recycling center enhances all recycling. It does not deter from recycling. We still have all of our curbside programs in place. And this year, in the year 2007, our upfront recycling program took out an additional 2,770 tons of recyclable materials that would have not been recycled previously if that facility had not been there. The amount of lead acid batteries and nasty things that we pull out of the trash is just significant. It helps significantly in the reduction of our air emission from our waste combustors.
And your 50% is it's pretty good. I mean, it's quite good for the
state. We hope to improve on it.
We can
hope
do better,
to improve.
It's great. Are you taking plastics out?
We have at our recycling drop-off center that we are capable of accepting plastics. We do. We have a station in the MRF right now ready to take out plastics. At this time, we currently are not. But it's there ready to go when we can get to all the steps in place for it.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for being here. I appreciate it. Any other questions? Okay. Let's move on to the next proposal, please. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, our second request is on the Washington County landfill. And as you already know, a landmark consent decree was negotiated by agency leadership and approved by our citizens board. And as a result of that agreement with 3M, they have contributed $8 million to deal with the PFC issue at Washington County landfill. And the remaining monies are what we're here today to request to address that problem. 3M is, as you are already aware, under no legal obligation under current law to provide these monies. And but agency leadership and with the cooperation of the Citizens Board, we were able to secure those funds to address that issue.
Thank you, Ms. Johnson. Who is your witness? If you'd like to please state your name for the record. Thank you.
My name is Jeff Lewis. I actually manage the closed landfill program at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Mm-hmm. And kind of following along in your handouts, the little bit of the history of the program, some of you I'm sure are well aware of this, but the closed landfill program was established in 1994. It was set up as an alternative to the federal Superfund program. At the time the law was implemented, we had about 59 landfills that were in the federal Superfund program. Our program has 112 facilities that are within it. In the Federal Superfund program, we as an agency were basically going after responsible parties that took materials to landfills when we were able to identify them. As part of that, and as a provision of the Federal Superfund law, those parties then were able to go after other contributors. And what was ending up happening in the early 90s was everybody was wasting a lot of time and money fighting about who took materials to landfills rather than worrying about cleaning up the materials that were there. So this program that was passed by the legislature was the first of its kind in the nation. Several other states are now following suit with similar programs. And it really does allow us to address the contamination issues at these sites. There's currently 92 sites that are publicly owned within our 112. There are 20 that are still privately owned. In 1994, the legislature authorized $90 million in bonding that was to be spent over about a 10-year period to partially fund the cleanup activities that we needed to do at the landfills that were in the program. From 94 through about the year 2000, we were able to spend about $34 million of those bonds for cleanup activities. And in 2004, there were some changes to the legislation on bonding that were passed that basically canceled our unused bonds. Ever since the year 2000, we've been back asking for additional bonding monies. And from 2001 through 2006, we received an additional $47 million in appropriations through the bonding process. Our total bonding appropriation to date is about $81.6 million for this program. In addition to the bonding money, when the program was set up, we had envisioned there to be basically three different funding sources for our work. About a third of the money was coming from bonding. About a third came from a solid waste tax that we all pay on our garbage, and about a third of our monies were coming from an insurance recovery program that we implemented as part of our work, where we basically went after insurance companies that had contamination policies on the landfills that came into the program. Through that effort, we've recovered about $78 million for the state of Minnesota that we've applied towards work in this program. Our total program expenditures through fiscal 08 will be about $273 million. And the next slide is kind of a series of pictures of the type of work that we do in the program. Starting at the top, we basically do a lot of investigations, both trying to figure out where the waste was placed, as well as a lot of the groundwater investigation work that we do. We do a lot of waste relocation activities. When we go in and try and fix landfills, one of the major things we're trying to do is reduce the footprint of the landfills, thereby reducing the contamination that's generated from them. We've shrunk the 112 landfills by about a third with the restoration work that we've done on sites. We've relocated about seven landfills in the program completely to different locations, and we've also, as part of our work, worked with local units of government to take care of some of the municipal dumps that were not in the program as well. Some of our major construction activities include trying to put an impervious cover over the waste after we reshape it. Those covers help us reduce the amount of rainwater that leachates through the waste and the groundwater contamination that results from it. We have about 22 sites where we have active gas extraction systems, where once we have an adequate cover, we can actually put that mound of waste under a vacuum, where we extract both the methane that's produced from the garbage as well as a lot of the other contaminants that are there. This past year, and we try and track this on an annual basis, but we've captured about 27 million pounds of methane. That's one of the more potent greenhouse gases that we emit, and those methane collection systems that we have in place have been very effective at reducing our greenhouse gas emissions. We have a number of sites. We have groundwater treatment systems. We have about 10 currently operating, and we do a lot of cover establishment and cover work. On the next page, as part of our O&M activities, we do a lot of post-closure and land use care. We have about 10,000 acres that are in the program. We do a lot of native grass plantings in areas where we can, and a lot of the areas that we are currently managing do provide very good wildlife cover. This picture was actually taken from the Washington County landfill that we're proposing to do work on. One of the other activities that we have been pretty successful at trying to implement is we have been trying to, instead of just flaring the methane, utilize it. We have two sites where we're currently generating electricity with the methane that we collect. One at Anoka Ramsey, where we're generating about 1 megawatt of electricity. And then we have another smaller facility at our WDE landfill. That's about 220 kilowatts, where we're trying some external Stirling combustion engines as an alternative. We do have the potential, we feel, at our landfills of generating somewhere between 8 and 10 megawatts of electricity, and we would hope to someday be able to implement more.
Madam Chair.
Oh, excuse me. Senator Chaudhry.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Curious about that methane. How big of a landfill do you need for it to be worth it to start making electricity from the methane?
There's kind of two different things to look at. By federal regulation, you have to have active gas collection systems if you have more than 5 million cubic yards. We've actually been able to find landfills that we have in our program down to under 1 million cubic yards that we're able to put in active gas collection systems and capture that methane. You get much below about 1 million cubic yards, and depending upon the waste, the age of the waste and where it was located, the moisture content of it, the methane generation, it's kind of questionable once you get below that 1 million cubic yards.
Last question, Madam Chair.
Senator Schott.
Is there a particular type of waste that has to be in the landfill?
Madam Chair and Senator Chaudhry, all of the landfills that are in our program took mixed municipal waste, so basically household garbage. A lot of them also took industrial. With that mixed municipal, basically you get a lot of organic matter. It's mainly the organic matter that's within the waste that's generating the methane.
Thank you.
Okay, go ahead, please.
The next slide is basically kind of a map showing you where the Washington County landfill is. I have to apologize. I don't know if it came out very well in black and white. The main intersection that you see in the center of the picture is 494 and Highway 5. And the Washington County landfill is actually about 2 miles to the northeast of that. You'll see it just south of a lake on the top of the photo. That's Lake Jane. This landfill accepted both mixed municipal solid waste as well as industrial waste. About 70% of the waste in it was mixed municipal and about 30% was industrial. It was operated by Washington and Ramsey counties and actually only operated for a short period of time from 1969 to 1975 and accepted about 2.5 million cubic yards of waste. Next slide is a little better picture of the site itself. It's about a 60-acre site. The existing waste footprint that's out there is about 37.4 acres. The landfill is in an unlined old gravel pit with the bottom of the waste being in groundwater. The site was accepted into the closed landfill program in 1996. The state assumed responsibility for the remediation and long-term care. The site's also located in a very sensitive, fractured bedrock aquifer, and it's also along kind of a groundwater divide that makes makes our control of the contaminant plumes there pretty difficult. Currently, that landfill is leaking PFCs as well as other contaminants into the groundwater system, and is the main reason we want to try and do some more remediation work out there. On the next slide, the work that we're as part of the work that we've done, We have looked at many different options for additional work at the site to try and control both the PFC as well as the other contaminants that are leaving that site. We had an independent third-party consulting firm that looked at six different alternatives for us to try and verify some of the work that we had done on alternative analysis. The most favorable option for long-term care and correction of the contaminants at that site was a dig-and-line option, and I'll explain that in a little bit more detail. Our original cost estimate for the work needed there is about $23 million, and as Christine had explained, $15 million of that we're hoping would come from bonding, and we have up to about $8 million from the 3M Corporation that was part of a consent decree that we had with them. On the next page, I've got a couple of pictures that show the type of work that we really propose to do. As part of this, we'll be excavating the waste on the site. The first picture is actually waste excavation that we did two summers ago at East Bethel Landfill. When wastes are located in groundwater, we've found that it's been extremely effective to get them out of that and at least have some separation distance. The next picture is actually of a large waste move that we did at the Winona County Landfill. I know several of you, I think, were down at that site a couple of years ago on a bonding tour. On that site, we actually picked up about 1.5 million cubic yards of waste and put it on a liner for many of the same reasons. It was in a karst area, and the contaminants from our landfill were leaching directly into the groundwater. On the next site, or I'm sorry, the next page, we have a picture of the liner and leachate collection system that we typically put under these landfills. This one, again, was from our Winona County landfill. And it's a little bit hard to see, but down in the lower right-hand side, you see a pipe going up the side that's actually the collection system that we have for the leachate so that we manage inside the liner any of the leachate that's generated from the site. After the liners are constructed, on the next page, we basically put the waste back on top. If the project's not funded, our only alternatives at this site are probably to try and look at some additional pump and treat work. We have a pump and treat system in place now that is not containing the PFCs that are being discharged from that facility. We feel we'd have to drastically increase our pumping rate as well as treat the water that we do remove from the ground. We basically, in our opinion, need to pump about 315 million gallons a year that we'd have to treat in carbon filtration systems to remove the PFCs. That cost for doing the treatment alone would run us somewhere between $0.5 and $1.2 million per year. The only other alternative we think we would have would be to basically do nothing that would result in the continued release of PFCs. It would also result in additional degradation of groundwater aquifers in Washington County. We currently have about 200 private wells that have been impacted from the PFC contamination emanating from this site, as well as the contaminant plume is actually commingled with a Superfund site as well. And in addition to that, if we don't do anything, the potential of additional impacts to municipal water supplies in Woodbury Lake, Omo, and Oakdale would be a real possibility. With that, I'll stop and hopefully be able to answer questions that you may have.
Great. Thank you very much. We've been Senator Sieben and Saltzman have asked to participate because this affects their district. So if you have questions, Senator Sieben, go ahead.
Thank you, Chairman Anderson and Chairwoman Anderson and Mr. Lewis. I have several questions. First, if PFCs weren't problematic or they weren't discovered in the past several years to be a problem and people have concerns over them, would this proposal be before us?
Madam Chair and Senator Sieben, we actually have additional work that is needed at that landfill. If PFC were not an issue, we would probably have about $5 million in cover upgrade work that would be needed. as well as we currently have ongoing O&M costs with our existing pump-out system that without the PFCs were in place to deal with some of the other contaminants that were there. So we had ongoing operations of currently about $200,000 a year for our pump and treat and flare systems on that particular site.
So just to be, thank you, Madam Chairwoman, just to be clear, so $5 million of the costs are not related to PFCs for this proposal.
Madam Chair and Senator Sieben, that's one way of looking at it. In addition, though, if we were to construct a liner system under it, we're really hoping that our long-term O&M activities would drastically decrease at the site.
I'm sorry, what's O&M?
I'm sorry, operation and maintenance, our groundwater pump-out systems that we currently maintain there.
Senator Sieben.
Thank you. And so you can't say specifically then that this request is to clean up PFCs because it's related to other contaminants at the Washington County landfill.
Lewis.
Madam Chair and Senator Sieben, that's correct. The actual waste that 3M put at that landfill was an extremely small percentage of the waste that's there. PFC is part of the driver right now, but there's also other activities that we would need to address there as well.
And Senator Sieben?
Just to be clear, thank you, Madam Chairwoman. Did 3M, in 1996, did 3M disclose to the state the presence of PFCs when it disposed of its waste in the Washington County landfill?
Mr. Lewis?
Madam Chair and Senator Sieben, I don't believe it was 1996. To the best of my recollection, it wasn't until 2004. I think 2003 or 2004 when we first got notified from 3M about their placement at that site as well as about 10 other locations.
Senator Sieben.
Thank you. And what was the, to move on to the timeline of when the MPCA determined that they needed to start to clean up or look at cleaning up the Washington County landfill, specifically the PFCs in the landfill, what date or what was the approximate date that the MPCA determined the cost of the cleanup?
Mr. Lewis?
Madam Chair and Senator Sieben, the actual date that we looked or determined a cost was kind of variable. We actually began in 2004 looking at other alternatives. We looked at the alternative of trying to install a pump-out system and sewer that water basically to the Pig's Eye wastewater treatment plant. We looked at options of pumping and treating it on land with carbon filtration or other media for about a year, and it wasn't until about a year ago that we looked at the option of actually digging it up and putting it on a liner.
Mr. Lewis and Madam Chair, I don't remember in the discussions over the consent agreement any of the actual costs being discussed with the Citizens Board or with the public or with the cities that may be impacted about the actual costs that taxpayers would incur as a result of this cleanup. Can you talk about that in any way? I mean, I guess I'm frustrated because, well, I'm frustrated for a lot of reasons, but regarding this issue. But when the consent order was very suddenly or very quickly agreed to in the spring, I don't recall any discussions by the board or by the commissioner about what the actual costs for the cleanup would be. So now it seems as though suddenly we have this bonding proposal before us just a few months after that consent order, and I don't recall any of those discussions taking place when the consent order was discussed with the Citizens Board.
Mr. Lewis?
Madam Chair and Senator Sieben, when the consent order was being negotiated with 3M, I was not actively involved in that, but Kathy Sather, my supervisor, was, who is here. But At the time, the consent order was basically negotiated to address the three Superfund sites that 3M had currently in the Superfund program. And the consent order was never put together to even address the cleanups required at the Washington County landfill. That was an addition that was negotiated into the consent order for any contribution from 3M. At the time, they were not legally responsible for any of the cleanup costs at the Washington County landfill. And I guess to complicate things a little bit more, at the time that that was being negotiated, we still felt that we were going to be able to install a pump and treat system. And at that time, the projected cost of that was in about a $5 million range. Subsequent to that, we were in the process of doing a bunch of additional tests and found that the quantity of water that we would have to pump and the treatment costs would really be extremely high. And so we looked at that other alternative of the Dakin line.
And Madam Chair, Chairwoman and Mr. Lewis, what percent of the PFCs will be cleaned up after you if this plan is implemented? So in other words, what leaching, if any, will there still be into the groundwater?
Mr. Lewis?
Madam Chair and Senator Sieben, we're anticipating that there would be no further discharge of any PFCs from this facility with the system that we would put in place. There would be a little bit of remnant PFC material that is in the groundwater that would be down gradient of our site. We would anticipate that that PFC material that's there would continue to dissipate with groundwater movement. We would not anticipate anybody's wells getting any worse than they currently are, and that they would slowly clean up just with the diffusion of the contaminants that are there. But we would expect to control 100% of the PFC discharge from our site.
And Madam Chairwoman and Mr. Lewis, just to follow up on that, so you're saying that is why the alternative analysis came back the way it did with this option as opposed to the plasma torch technology. Is that because this is the best option then, not just based on the cost estimates, but also because it's the most efficient and most effective to clean up the PFCs?
That's correct. Madam Chair and Senator Sieben, we would, you know, and one of the six alternatives that we looked at was digging the material up and incinerating it basically with a plasma torch technology. The cost of operating that system was extremely high, and it would take us a long period of time in order to do that. And we did feel that the dig and line option, even though it's going to take us about 3 years to do, would be much quicker and fix the problem in a little better way.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Senator Salton.
Yes. And Madam Chair, I just want to thank you and this committee for the tremendous work and urgency that you felt when this problem was discovered last year. When we look back where we were a year ago and where we are today, certainly, people want things to go even faster, but you know, in this committee, you have responded with our water filter study and several other initiatives as well. So I want to thank you so much. I wonder if Mr. Knopf could provide some background on the closed landfill program, because I think there's a sense that this is a significant amount of money. And in a year when the bonding committee feels very, very stretched, I think to have an understanding of what this legislature did several years ago, and maybe to have an understanding. Mr. Knopf, would that be possible, Madam Chair?
Well, and Senator Saltzman, we can also ask Mr. Mueller to tell us about the overall budget, because I was going to ask the question about what was in the agency's original request to the governor and what's being left behind by this changed proposal in the governor's bonding bill. So who wants to? Mr. Knopf?
Madam Chair, whichever you want to do first, but Madam Chair, Senator Saltzman,
I think the agency described it to some extent in 94, that some of the activities that were going on at the time where it seemed like there was more spent on legal fees than actually cleaning up some of these sites, that Superfund wasn't a very appropriate basically method for cleanup at these sites. And what the legislature did was took over these sites as long as they had to be permitted during a certain time period. If they were prior to the state permitting some of the open dumps of the past, those weren't included in the program. So as long as there was a state permit, then the state would take over the responsibility for these sites. And the state also, in the statute, it says that the state will not go back to the responsible parties to recover. So basically, the state through several sources, it was mentioned the insurance recovery. There's the solid waste tax, and then the bonding. And originally there was $90 million in bonding, and there were some subsequent changes in the way bonding works, kind of in a general format. So some of that was lost. There was a schedule that was put in place for the $90 million that you could sell. The $90 million was appropriated at the beginning, but you couldn't sell. There was a sale schedule that was put in law. And so that basically because of the changes that were made, they did lose some of that bonding authority. So they've had to come back in the early 2000s here to recover some of that bonding money, because that was part of what was considered a kind of a three-legged stool or whatever for funding back then. There also was some of the assurance funding that a lot of the landfills were required to have, all that money also had to pass through to the state, whatever wasn't spent. If they were going through, if they were already under a Superfund order, they had to go through and fulfill those requirements, then come into the state. And then the ones that weren't under had to sign a compliance agreement with the state, and then the state would basically send out a compliance letter once they complied. Now, every landfill in the state could opt out of this. There was an option to opt out, but I think most of the 106 originally, I think most of them all ended up coming to this. There might be a couple that would have been eligible early on that never came into the program. But so basically the state takes over the responsibility for the site and promises not to go back after the responsible parties. I mean, that's what it says in the statute, that the state basically will not do that. And so it basically becomes a state responsibility for the cleanup and all of the post-closure care. In fact, half of the insurance recovery money, and there's also some money that was set aside from the solid waste fund a number of years ago, plus all half the insurance money goes into a long-term investment fund that will be for the kind of the post-closure care down the road, 30 years from now, because the state is basically responsible for all these 112 sites. And I think, as the agency said, all but 20 of them are publicly owned. There is an option for the state to acquire even the private owned ones and then put them in public ownership down the road. But that's, I don't know if you have any further questions, but kind of give you a little bit of background what happened in 1994. And some of you may remember, even if you weren't part of the legislative process, that the Oak Grove landfill and kind of the poster child of how bad Superfund was at addressing these sites, where basically everybody in communities was getting sent form letters from attorneys to basically pay up to this group that was going to manage the cleanup. And then they were basically told, well, if you pay it by a certain date, it's like 50% or whatever of what we think we've calculated that you owe. And so there was just so much going on in litigation at the time and not much in the way of cleanup.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. And I may have some more questions.
That's helpful.
Later.
Let's ask Mr. Mueller, too, if you could add to that on the dollars. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I'm briefly looking at the agency request here, and so far, the legislature has authorized $81 million of bonding for this program. The original agency request was for $31.4 million to basically, looks like here, complete their list of at 12 sites. Now, what I don't know, it's clear if this $15 million for Washington County was part of that $31.4. Okay. And then there's also a note here in the agency request here that in 2006, the Pollution Control Agency estimated the cost of future obligations relating to closed landfills at $199 million. So there's
will be ongoing need here.
Yeah, that'll take us a while at this rate. I'd like to get an answer about just briefly about what's not. You said that the request that your agency made was for 12 sites, and so what are the 11 other sites that won't get funded under the governor's work?
Madam Chair, the original proposal that we submitted actually included 13 projects at 12 sites. One of the projects was asking for money to enhance our landfill gas to energy, where we're actually generating electricity. But the other 12 sites that we had included, or actually other 11, was included WLSSD, which is a landfill up in Duluth, that we actually received some bonding money for, but we do not have enough to move that project forward yet. We need about $2.5 million at that one. We have an Albert Lee project that's kind of in conjunction with a city proposal. The city of Albert Lee received $3.6 million in bonding in the 2006 bonding request to take care of an Edgewater dump, a city-owned dump. We were trying to work with them to relocate that dump to an Albert Lee closed landfill that's in our program. We have some work needed at our site, and we're trying to work in conjunction with them. We needed about $500,000 in order to make that work on our end. The other sites that we have include Hopkins, Isani Shishago Landfill, East Mesaba, Kuchiching County, Mille Lacs County Landfill, Sun Prairie, which is in Le Sueur County, Wabasha County, Painesville, and Anoka Ramsey. Those were the other sites.
And just do you know off the top of your head how many of those sites are now leaking any kind of contaminants into the water, into the groundwater?
Madam Chair, I would venture to say all of them are. Otherwise, we wouldn't be doing additional work at them.
But they're going to be deferred now for at least 2 more years. Could you get us that specific list, please, for this committee?
We certainly could.
Thank you. Other questions? Senator Rummel?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know who to direct this question to. I'm looking at part of the presentation, and the site was accepted in 1996 for this purpose. And then right below that, it says the site is located in a sensitive, fractured bedrock aquifer along a groundwater divide. What criteria do we have for where we establish a landfill? I mean, this seems like the most inappropriate place to locate one. And then not to have liners. I don't know. How do we decide where we put them?
Mr. Lewis, can you answer that?
Madam Chair and Senator Rummel, your assessment of past practices is extremely correct. Most of the landfills that we took into this program, the 112, were placed in one of two locations, either in old gravel pits where they're typically in contact with groundwater, or they were put in swamps where they're even more in contact with groundwater. Those were the two disposal areas that most people used at that time of the year, of our existence here, I guess. There are now much better standards for placements of, or for locating landfills that require separation distances from groundwater, and all new landfills that are constructed do have to have liners and leachate collection systems. The 112 that we're dealing with, most of them started out as old city dumps, where garbage was typically dumped and burned, and then when, I guess, as kind of a slow progression, we decided that burning garbage wasn't a good idea, so we started having them place the garbage there and put dirt over the top instead. And it wasn't until later on that the actual requirements for liners actually came into being. So most of these landfills predated any of the requirements for having liners and leachate collection systems.
Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When did those new criteria come forward?
Mr. Lewis. Madam Chair and Senator Rummel, I think those requirements for liners and leachate collection systems didn't come into play until the mid to late 80s.
But this is 1996 that this was accepted into the system.
Madam Chair and Senator Rummel, that's the landfill was already there. The landfill actually took waste from 69 to 75, and then it was closed. It was no waste place after 75.
It opened it.
In that interim period, it just sat there,
basically,
until it came into our program and we attempted to try and do some cleanup work at it.
So just imagine all those years sitting there leaking into the groundwater. I mean, just the price we pay for past mistakes is so enormous. A good lesson to keep in mind. Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that I would like to ask if this committee could do a serious review of this, because I think Senator Rummel's questions are very important, especially when we have a request for 1 year for $46 million for...
That's 23.
Well, if we combine all of them, so they have a request for 23, then 15 million is for bonding, and then 8 million is a contribution. So altogether, we have a 46 million project here just to do remediation. And the question for me is, how long are we going to do this? Are we going to come back again? Is this mean that with this request, we're done with this project, or we will come back 5 years from now? Because if we have 112 sites, can we afford to go in this trend of every 2 years having to come up to clean up these mistakes? And I wonder how much it's going to cost us.
Well, and Senator Torres Ray, at the rate that it's proposed in the bonding bill, it'll take decades just to clean up the ones that are already on the list anyway. Decades. At this rate, so it's even worse. Do you want to try to answer, please,
well,
Mr. Lewis?
Madam Chair and Senator Torres Ray, actually, most of the sites, these 112, we feel we have pretty well under control. We only have the 14 that we had, or I'm sorry, the 12 that were on the list of additional bonding requests, plus two other privately owned ones that we feel we have major construction work left to complete. After that work is done, we basically feel we will be done with the major construction. We'll still have to operate systems, and we'll still have some maintenance costs involved. But we're really hoping that with the 14 sites that we have left, that we'll be done with the construction work needed.
And then just to clarify, what would be the cost of completing all of those 14 sites?
Madam Chair, unfortunately, the two private ones that we have left to work on are extremely large. The work that we have left totals $87 million in construction. The ones that were bond eligible would be about $30 million of that, and the remainder would have to come out of other sources of funding. The two big ones we have left, we have some major work to do at the Flying Cloud Landfill and a major work to do at Freeway Landfill.
Where's Freeway Landfill?
Freeway Landfill is a 5 million cubic yard site located on the Minnesota River, right on the west shore of 35W in the city of Burnsville.
Mm. Okay, Senator Saltzman?
Yes, you know, this site is the source of the PFBA that is in the drinking water of approximately 60,000 people in my district. And I hear the discussion today talking about, well, why, you know, why? How did this happen? And the issue is that we can certainly discuss that and go back and talk about decisions that were made that maybe at the time people were not aware of how this was going to impact the future of our precious water. But for the people in my community and Senator Sieben's community, there is a concern that how are we going to address this now? And that's why this proposal, and I know that the MPCA people have, you know, made comments, well, why didn't we hear about this sooner, and all these kind of things. And at the same time, I go back to what has been accomplished in the past year. And the fact that looking at it takes time to come up with these, you know, proposals, evaluations. I do have the mayors here today from Woodbury and Lake Elmo, and they represent the people in this community as well. And I hope that we have time for just them to testify a little bit about the importance of this project to these communities. And certainly I understand that there is concern. This is not a permanent solution. And that I don't believe we have a permanent solution yet. We've talked about the plasma torches. And from the research that, you know, I've been trying to do in talking with people, we aren't really sure that the plasma torches are really effective and what is the emission standards with those. I know that there's been some proposals in the state, but in order for that to be done, so is this in a way something, and it's a very significant investment, is this a way for us to contain this contamination? Because it, when we hear about the leaching that is going on, the levels right now, there is a lot of work being done on, you know, what is a healthy level, what can, you know, what is the level currently in this community, and containing this is very, very, very important to this community. So I just share that with you of speaking on behalf of my district.
You know, Senator Saltzman, I appreciate your comments very much, and I agree with you that it's critically urgent to address this and to protect the drinking water in your community. But I also hear you saying this isn't, you know, this large amount of money isn't going to solve the problem over the long run. And so that concerns me as well. And also the fact that there's 12 other sites that may also be immediately right now contaminating drinking water for a lot of other Minnesotans. And that is a huge concern. We don't have all that information in front of us today. But it may be just as urgent for some of those communities as well. So we really need to know.
Absolutely, Madam Chair. And so I guess to that point is that are these other sites, you know, is there a need to increase funding for the MPCA so that we can clean up all of these sites? Is that something that, we should be looking at? Because I'm concerned that when I'm hearing discussion, it's that if this is too much, where is the money going to come from? The other issue is that one of the proposals that is considered more of a permanent solution to my community is to dig and truck. And that's just taking this waste and putting it in somebody else's community. Mm-hmm. That seems to be the permanent solution that my community thinks would be just fine. Mm. I'm just saying, I'm just suggesting that what is permanent, do we have the technology now? But you know, in the meantime, are we able to contain this for a significant number of years until we're able to define and find that, you know, technology mm-hmm. to permanently rid ourselves of this waste?
Senator Stephen.
Thank you, Senator Anderson, Senator Saltzman, for your comments. I think that one, and I agree with you, that this is just part of the solution, but I think it's also incumbent on us to keep in mind that we as legislators need to continue to put pressure on the Department of Health to set those health-based values for what mm-hmm. levels are determined to be safe or not. Because, yes, perhaps at this Washington County site, if this proposal would go forward and if it would indeed stop the leaching at this particular site, there are still PFCs throughout the many other parts of the state that impact other communities, including mine. So until the Department of Health really comes forward and sets health-based values that are appropriate and that are taken into consideration the real safety of the needs of the people across the state, we're not going to have any sort of larger solution. And I think it's important to note, too, that my understanding of the way health-based values work and HRLs work is the Department of Health will set them, and then the PCA is responsible for ensuring that communities have levels that are below those levels that are set. Mm-hmm. So until, for instance, the Department of Health sets a level for PFBA, and if it is determined that, for instance, St. Paul Park and Newport have very high levels compared to some other communities of PFBA, then the Pollution Control Agency is responsible for ensuring that there are carbon filtration systems or bottled water made available to residents of those areas. And it's been frustrating, to say the least, that the Department of Health has taken so long to set these levels for PFBA. And I know they're working on it, and it keeps getting pushed back, but it's very important that these levels get set so there can be, so we don't have to wait for the landfill to be remediated, but in the interim, people can come to expect to have safe levels of drinking water.
Thank you. Senator Chaudhry.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And to Mr. Knopf, you had talked about earlier about some of the things we passed in statute, I believe. Are there any policy implications from the proposals that we're hearing today that we should be aware of?
Madam Chair, Senator Chaudhry, I don't think so. The goal in 94 was that some of the money would come from production of new waste, basically, and some of it would come from the general taxpayer, and that was what the insurance recovery, and this would be part of the general taxpayer's payment towards cleaning up this problem. And it's like, again, it was originally $90 million. They looked at over a 10-year period from 1994 to 2004. Because of the change in the bonding in the way bonds canceled, they only spent, $35 million, I think, early on. But then they've had some bonding appropriations since then. So I think the total right now sits at about 80. They've gotten about $81 million in bonding authority. The original plan was for $90 million. So this would be a little bit, once you put if you put $15 million into this, you're a little over the $90 million that was originally thought about in 1994. But I think you can also say that the total cost of the program are probably higher than what was originally perceived in 1994 also.
So, Madam Chair, Mr. Knopf, you had referenced something in statute that absolves the polluter from contributing to the cleanup.
Could
you repeat that?
Madam Chair, Senator Chaudhry, it didn't necessarily absolve them. But what it said was that the state was going to be taking over to clean up these sites, and that as a part of that, what the commissioner, let me see if I can find it here. Was that the as a part of the state taking over that site, that the state would not notice of compliance effects. When the commissioner provides a written notice of compliance to the appropriate owner, beginning on the date of notice of compliance, the commissioner shall assume all obligations of the owner or operator or person for the environmental response actions under the Federal Superfund Act and any federal or state cleanup orders. The commissioner shall not seek recovery against the owner or operator of the facility or any responsible person of any of the costs incurred by the commissioner for environmental response action at or related to the facility, except, and then there are some exceptions if there was some illegal activity or some other things. There's also the insurance exception. But basically, what this says is once the notice of compliance, and apparently this is in 1996 when this one went through the process and received their notice of compliance, the state basically said the commissioner, the PCA, would assume all obligations, and the commissioner would not seek recovery against the owner-operator or any other responsible person after that time.
And Madam Chair, the history behind that is what? Is that related to
the history,
litigation?
Yes. Madam Chair, Senator Chaudhry, the history is related to litigation. It was the concern was that if without those provisions in this law, that it would just continue on. Back in the early 90s, Superfund just was not a very good tool because everybody in all of these landfills, since they took municipal waste, basically we all were responsible for the waste that went into these landfills. And the question is how far do you go? If you get a few big responsible parties that clean it up, and then they can go ahead and sue other people for their costs. And it just became this large problem because there were communities where everybody on Main Street basically was being asked to contribute to these and not knowing exactly what their contribution was. It's very difficult to figure out in a landfill Superfund site where you've got a few responsible parties, you can usually figure out who's responsible, how much of the responsibility. Even that can get complicated. But in these, it was near impossible to figure it out. And that was why, again, we had the insurance recovery as kind of a third of it, the solid waste tax kind of charged for new garbage, so basically based on your production of garbage, and then to have the general taxpayer kind of pick up the other third was the thought at the time.
So were there major contributions made by private companies at the time
of this statute. And it basically was thought, well, we'll pass the statute. You give one last contribution, then we'll say that you're done. Is that how it worked?
Madam Chair, Senator Chaudhary, not exactly. I mean, there was the insurance recovery. So if somebody had an insurance policy that covered, especially for the large contributors or for the owner, then the state went through a process of negotiating with those insurance companies and possibly taking them to court. I think they were able to sign a global agreement for all of the landfills, or they were able to sign an agreement that would be kind of landfill specific if they were only involved in that one landfill. But there was the insurance recovery, but there was also landfill operators were supposed to have kind of an assurance fund that was actually kind of adopted later. Many of these insurance funds weren't large enough to really cover the cost because the legislature didn't start requiring that until I think the late 1980s. And so we did recover all of the money, and if they were under a cleanup order, some of these landfills, there were already responsible parties that were under a cleanup order, they were required to go through and fulfill all the requirements that they had prior to that. So there was some cleanup. They had to basically spend whatever they agreed to spend already on it before it was passed on to the state. So there was some activity, but we didn't go after responsible parties as a state prior to, like, except for that the insurance money, and then for the financial assurance money that any landfill had put up.
So last question, Mr. Knopf, is it possible that there are responsible parties that are not contributing to the cleanup?
Madam Chair, Senator Chaudhary, yes. That was kind of that was basically how this worked, any future action going after responsible parties would cease.
Thank you.
Senator Chaudhary, thanks for your good questions. It's a good discussion to have. We're going to have to wrap this up in the next 10 minutes, or by 12:15 sharp. And I've already told Bowser that they'll have to come back on another day, so we apologize to them for having to wait. But what I'd like to do, I have one more question, and then we'll very briefly bring up the mayors. If they could just make a comment for 1 minute each, that's all we have time for now. I just wanted to ask on the first part of your request on the waste-to-energy facility, again, in terms of the governor's rec compared to what the original agency request was, tell us what is not getting funded, please.
Madam Chair and members, there were two applications this year. So in addition to Pope Douglas, Hennepin County had put in a $2 million bonding request to put in a household hazardous waste facility that would serve the metropolitan area as well, because they would be into a reciprocal type agreement where people in other counties could drop off waste and that would be reimbursed back. So it was a reciprocal type thing. So that was for $2 million. And I think the total project cost of that was, I've got some notes on it, but was just under $10 million.
And can you tell us what's the impact of that if they don't get the money? What will happen? I mean, will it go forward, and is it going to have a direct impact on collection of that waste?
Madam Chair and members, I guess I don't really have the knowledge as to what kind of an impact it would have. There's other infrastructure in place in those counties. I mean, there's already household hazardous waste management opportunities for people. I think that this location in the city and so forth is a prime spot that they would expect to get a tremendous amount of participation. So
over here I calculate how much.
And yeah, and we can look into that specifically and get back to you on
that's
that.
That's great. Thank you very much. All right. Thank you for your time and your answers to all these questions. We appreciate it. And let's bring the two mayors up very briefly. As long as they took the time to be here.
How much money I'm going to give to the Federal Land Bank.
I was just curious. Why not all these numbers in your head?
These numbers here. It's just, these are the number of lights it takes to get into the room.
You're great.
Which seems like a lot.
Welcome to the committee. Okay. Who wants to go first? Go ahead, please.
Well, I'm Bill Hargis, mayor of Woodbury, and we're a community of 58,000 on the east side of the Twin Cities area. A safe drinking water supply is one of the most critical functions that people look to the government to provide. So I'd urge your support for the PCA. We have been leaning on them in the last year to get more aggressive with their cleanup actions, and it's not satisfactory just to pump and treat water and hope for the best, because this chemical that they're proposed that's stopping leaks does not naturally occur in the drinking water, and I think it's not an unreasonable expectation for people not to have that chemical in. And the sooner we get the chemical out, that can alleviate the health fears that people have. So our point is the time for action is now. You've had some of the important background, but just think about one of the most important services that government provides is a safe drinking water supply, and that's what this is will help us all accomplish.
Thank you so much, Mayor. Appreciate your comments.
Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Dean Johnston. I'm the mayor of the city of Lake Elmo. We have people in Lake Elmo who have lived next to this this problem for 39 years, and I would be remiss if I didn't share their frustration. The concern that we have is for a permanent solution. It's my understanding that the proposal that is currently before you includes a liner with a life of probably 40 to 50 years. Now, that is not in our book a permanent solution. We would much prefer to see the waste placed over a less dangerous situation for the aquifer, the dig in line is certainly very preferable to not doing anything. We need to do something now. We would prefer the dig and truck option. Thank you for all the work that you've done.
Thank you very much, Mayor. Senator Torres Ray.
I know we're pressing for time, but I can't resist, Madam Chair, so I have to say this. And I have to say this to Senator Saltzman, that it is not that we are not convinced about the need and the urgency. Of course, we understand the urgency and the need. What is problematic for us is that, as you can see, some of us are struggling to figure out how do we get our counties and our projects into the budget. My county is not going to get the money. And so Senator Saltzman, who is an incredible senator and an advocate for our community, is going to have to fight with me because we don't have a big enough pie. And both of our projects are very urgent. So I think that for our constituents, it's very important to know that we're going to be working very hard to divide a pie amongst us, and there are not enough pieces in the pie. And until we get the support from your communities to get a larger pie, there are not enough pieces for us. And that is a very, very, it's very complex. And I want the two mayors to really understand that, because it is not that this project does not merit our support, all of our support, but it's just that we don't have the money to do it. And so, Senator Saltzman, we're going to be talking about this, and I know that this is going to be challenging.
Senator Saltzman.
You know, Madam Chair, I really appreciate that point. And Senator Torres Ray, I think that I've spent significant time in your community visiting your schools, because all of us have challenges. And right now the challenge in my community is that people are concerned about their drinking water. I am equally concerned about the children in your community who don't achieve. And with many things, I sit on transportation and education. Prevention would be wonderful. You know, earlier intervention with kids, also with our transportation system, with our maintenance. And here we have another issue where we can't go back and change the situation. But I have 60,000 people who are looking to us to be state senators on this issue, and I hope that you will consider that. Thank you.
All right, thank you very much for your testimony. Members, again, we're going to have a discussion among ourselves about how we should use our input as a division to make recommendations to Senator Langseth's committee, and so I would welcome your thoughts and ideas about that as we move forward. So the next bonding hearing is Monday at 9 a.m. See y'all then. Thank you.
Thank you.
Meeting's adjourned. Oh, and senators, I want to invite senators who are baseball fans, come to my office.